Yeah, so I like to show this movie on my title slide, usually because I'm about to talk about why you need to care about these processes in dwarf galaxies. Today, it turns out what you're seeing here isn't directly related to what I'm talking about. I'm just taking advantage of the fact that I'm the first speaker and I get to show you movies over and over while you're still waiting. Yeah, all right, I guess I have one of these. All right, so yeah, I'm going to be talking about the abundance of dwarf galaxies. And specifically, I'm going to focus on work that is in two papers, one that has been on the archive since the end of January, and one that is actually supposed to appear on the archive tonight. And I'm going to be just highlighting the work in these papers. The first one is directly related to the abundance of dwarf galaxies and asking whether or not what we see is consistent with Lambda CDM. Right, so some of you are probably aware of this figure, right? So this, what you're looking at here is the H1 velocity function of observed galaxies. Right, so this is the number density of galaxies as a function of rotational velocity. Most of the data in here, this is from Clipin et al., but most of the data in here is coming from Alfalfa. And Clipin et al. Also extended to a local volume catalog where they've included low-mass spheroidal and elliptical galaxies as well. And the main point is this black line here is the prediction from theory, right? Just as you expect in CDM, there are more small galaxies than big galaxies. But compared to the data at about 20 kilometers per second rotational velocity, there's essentially an order of magnitude missing dwarfs, right? Or it's lower than the predictions by an order of magnitude. And so this has been called the missing dwarf problem, right? And no longer just have a missing dwarf problem in satellites, we also have a missing dwarf problem in the field. Okay, however, the real problem with that plot is that we're not comparing apples to apples. Right, so most of the theory is taken from a dark matter-only simulation, say something like Bolshoi, where for every halo in the simulation, you can plot up a circular velocity curve, and what usually is taken as a rotational velocity is something like Vmax. In fact, it is Vmax in that plot I just showed you. However, the observations don't have that option, right? This is nice resolved data. The observations, like I said, most of them are coming from Alfalfa, where you've got unresolved data. So you have to use the width of the H1 profile, right? So for a nice spiral galaxy, of course, if you're not familiar with this classic double horn profile, for a nice spiral galaxy, part of it is redshifted, part of it's blueshifted, and as you pile up H1 along the flat part of a rotation curve, you get this characteristic double horn peak. The observations will then use the width of that profile at 50% of the peak height. And technically, W50 over 2 would then be equal to the rotation velocity of that galaxy, which they assume has some is some relation to Vmax. I always forget that I'm holding this. All right, so what I have done is asked, what if I actually do this in an apples-to-apples way? I can take all of my simulated galaxies and create mock H1 data, and that's what you're seeing here, just for three different galaxies at three different masses. Here's roughly Milky Way mass galaxy, classic double horn profile. Here's something about 100 times lower in mass, and here's something even lower in mass. And you can see as you go to lower mass galaxies here, that classic double horn profile goes away and becomes more Gaussian as you get to galaxies where you don't fully trace the flat part of the rotation curve. So for each one of those galaxies, right, I have the true Vmax from the simulation, and I now have fake H1 data, and I can just ask how well do those match. If they match, all of these galaxies would be sitting at 1. They clearly don't match at all, right? So each one of these black points is an individual simulation. The squares are satellites, which I've included here because they seem to follow the same trends as the centrals. Maybe that's not surprising because these are all satellites that have lots of H1 still. And the red are just binned data. At the high mass end, this is, people think we understand this very well, right? High mass galaxies, the baryons cool to the center, they increase the rotational velocity compared to what you expect from a dark matter-only Vmax. And so we think this is fairly well understood. The question is, what's going on in these dwarf galaxies? The dotted line, by the way, is the rotational velocity suppression you expect if the dwarfs just had blown out all their baryons. And you can see it's significantly lower than if they had just lost all their baryons. So before I come to why that is, let me just show you the effect that has on the predictions. So again, here in the black line is the Vmax function you expect from a dark matter-only simulation. If I then just say, at a fixed abundance of galaxies, how much does that velocity shift, shift you over, right, you get that blue line. And so essentially that velocity shift, going from theoretical to just observational, can explain the entire shift. So why is that happening? What I'm about to say here I don't think will shock most people in the room. Okay, so let's focus, we're focusing on the dwarf galaxies, right? So this toy cartoon here, the blue points represent H1 data, right? So it typically in dwarfs you have H1 data that is still on where the outermost H1 is still on the it's still on the rising part of the rotation curve. And so you don't fully trace the max value, the Vmax in that dwarf. That's, I think, surprises very few people, right? You can see it can be about 60% or so of the true Vmax. However, if you then ask, is that what W50 is measuring? The answer is no. W50 is actually still measuring something even smaller than the rotation velocity at the outermost H1 point. Again, it's something like 60 to 80% of even the outermost H1 tracer. Okay, before I explain why that is, I will point out if you are able to use W20, right, the width of the profile at 20% of the peak height, turns out that works a lot better. Okay, why is that? It's again because of this classic double horn profile versus the Gaussian that you get more in dwarf galaxies. Here, right, you can see when you've got this Gaussian shape, if you're measuring at 50% of the peak height versus 20%, so you're going to get a very big difference in the observed rotation velocity. That's not true in more massive galaxies with this classic double horn profile, because you can see that 50% versus 20% is not giving you a significant velocity difference. Okay. So that's really it. The point I want to drive home here is that you can start, right? You basically, this says you can start with the abundance of dwarf galaxies we predict in CDM, and it's purely a shift in velocities. The discrepancy is not in the y-axis, the discrepancy is along the x-axis. All right, and so I did this work with Manolis Papasturgis, and I said, well, this is clearly an observational bias. And as an observer, he said, well, what are you talking about? It's clearly a theoretical bias. But yeah. But now that we can compare apples to apples, it does not look like we are missing dwarf galaxies. So I will switch over to topic number two. Okay. Like I said, this is a paper that should appear on archive tonight. And the topic at hand now, focusing it still on these dwarf galaxies, is what is going on down here at the lowest stellar mass to halo mass relation. All right. You can see, most people are aware, I think, that above a halo mass of 10 to the 10, a lot of the determinations for the stellar mass to halo mass relationship are in agreement, right? There's very little scatter up there. I have on here the Mostert et al. Relationship. Here's Brook et al. Beirutzi is hidden, but there it is. It's right up there. And Sawala. Okay, so to answer this question, is this working? I am going to look at a volume of dwarf galaxies. So that's what you're seeing here, right? This is essentially a sheet of dwarf galaxies out in the field. This is shown at redshift zero, its dark matter density and its gas density, and we're just zooming in on the most massive dwarf in this volume, which happens to be about SMC mass. It's a dwarf galaxy, it's probably not that exciting, huh? Okay. So we have a number of these dwarf volumes. The one that is done all the way to redshift zero, we're calling Captain Marvel. All right, so that's the data you're going to see today. We have three more in that are being run. Electra is almost done, and Storm and Rogue are running, and they're really big runs, so they might take a little while. But eventually, the goal is to have something like 100 dwarf galaxies of SMC mass and smaller for comparison to the local volume. All right, so here's the result. All right, so there's a lot of information in this plot. Let me highlight the main points. If you focus on the colored points, these are the well-resolved halos in this run. And by well-resolved, we're talking about halos with a halo mass greater than 10 to the 7. Right? So that actually comes out to be more than 1,500 particles, dark matter particles. And they have stellar masses more than about 600 stellar masses. solar masses, so that they have multiple particles and we can sort of trust that their star formation history has converged. The colored points are colored by their V-band magnitude, okay, up, as shown by the scale bar up here. The squares are satellites, which we'll come back to in a minute. The blue, the circles are central galaxies. And the stellar masses for the colored points are determined from photometric colors, just like an observer would do. And the dark matter halo masses actually come from a dark matter-only version of the run, right? Because typically when people are determining the stellar mass to halo mass relationship, they're using an observed luminosity function and results from a dark matter-only run. And as Yoke pointed out the other day, it makes a difference, right? The halo masses in a dark matter-only run are not the same as in the baryonic run, because baryonic processes have actually caused the halo mass to shrink a bit in the baryonic run. So all these little duplicated gray points that you see here are the same results from directly from the baryonic run. So you can see how much of a difference that makes. So if we ignore the well-resolved criteria and just say, let me throw in anything that makes a star, right, even if it's one star particle, that gives you these gray points down here. And we've piled up dark halos right here along log m star equals zero. So the main thing you want to notice right away is that down here, there is no simple one-to-one abundance matching relationship anymore, right? That breaks down at the low mass end. Yes. Yeah, we can talk more about that in the discussion. All right, so let me show you, though, what happens when you switch from using the halo mass at redshift zero to using the maximum halo mass, right? For those satellites, this is going to make a difference. So as I shift back and forth here, this plot is directly from the baryonic run, so you'll see some shift at the high mass end just because I've switched over to using the baryonic results, and I've also gotten rid of the dark halos. All right, but if you focus on this region, right, that's what I want you to notice here, most of the scatter at about, you know, 10 to the 7 and in halo mass and 10 to the 5 in stellar mass is actually coming from these satellites which have been shifted. Are we going to do this? Yeah?
Sorry, I just wanted to know if you wanted to finish your sentence.
Yeah.
You said something in passing. I'm not sure if I understood exactly what you meant by that, which is like some of the shift is you switch to the baryonic.
Yeah, on this slide, the dark matter halo masses are coming from the dark matter only run, and the stellar masses are coming from photometric measurements. Here, I've just taken it directly out of the particle masses from the simulations instead, in the baryonic simulation. Yeah, so that's why you see a slight I always do that, a slight shift up at the high mass end too. Right. Yeah. Yeah, so if you focus, for instance, here on these yellow satellites, right, watch where they end up, right? They actually shift over by at least an order of magnitude. So these are satellites that have fallen into dwarf galaxies, right? These are satellites of dwarf galaxies, and they've fallen in, and after infall, they have lost more than an order of magnitude in halo mass through tidal stripping. And so that is where most of the scatter at that low mass end is actually coming from. And you can see something similar in Tilsawala's 2015 paper. It wasn't emphasized, but it definitely was shown. You know, this bend, this classic bend that Til emphasized, is really due to satellites, right? These are all satellites in his simulation. Okay. So let me switch emphasis here and now talk about the scatter in the relationship. Okay, so at the high mass end, there is very little scatter. We have very few galaxies there, so the scatter is about 0.1 dex. Typically, it's thought that the scatter at the high mass end is about 0.2 dex. But down here, this is just for the well-resolved galaxies, the scatter in just these colored points is nearly an order of magnitude, nearly 1 dex. Why does that matter? Well, Shea had a lovely paper out on archive last year, now published this year, where he showed why you need to care about this, right? So these are two different representations of the stellar mass to halo mass relationship. The purple line here has the slope of 1.8 with no scatter, though. There's no scatter in relationship, whereas this is a steeper version, slope of 2.6, but lots of scatter in the relationship. And why this is important is that as you scatter these galaxies, the halo mass function is very steep. So at a given stellar mass, you're more likely, but just in pure numbers, to scatter low-mass galaxies up to a given stellar mass than you are high-mass galaxies down to a given stellar mass. Right, so that means in order not to overproduce the stellar mass function that you observe, you actually need a steeper stellar mass to halo mass relationship as your scatter gets bigger. Okay, so in this paper that's out tonight, we've actually provided a tool to populate halos stochastically, and that's what you're seeing here for 200,000 halos taken from the same cosmology. We've populated a bunch of low mass halos given these trends. So you can see here above 8.4 in stellar mass, we essentially have a stellar mass to halo mass relationship that's consistent with Mostar et al. And we adopt a scatter of 0.2 at the highest mass n. Below this mass, in order to fit the galaxies that we see down here, we have to have a bend in the slope, so it changes to 0.64 at the lower halo masses, and then the scatter grows. So it grows as you go to lower masses. So the scatter grows like this, right? It's fixed above this halo mass, and it grows as gamma below that, right? So gamma is minus 0.26 here. The other thing that we've done to populate this, though, is require that the fraction of dark galaxies matches what we see, too. Okay, so that's what you see here. This is actually the number of luminous galaxies, fraction of luminous galaxies compared to all the galaxies in the simulation as a function of halo mass. Okay, so what impact does that have on the stellar mass function? Well, you can see most of the scatter is happening at pretty low halo masses, right? So the galaxies that populate this range are ultra faints. And so our prediction is, if, you know, assuming that this model is correct, that as we probe ultra faint dwarf galaxies, the stellar mass function should increase in the ultra faint range. Right? And so we've highlighted in gray here the mass range found by the DES survey. And I think that's it, all right? So my conclusions are, first of all, the abundance of dwarf galaxies is fine, right? There does not actually seem to be a missing dwarf problem in the field when you compare apples to apples in terms of rotational velocity of your galaxies. The scatter and the stellar mass halo mass relationship increases with decreasing halo mass. There is no one-to-one assignment. The bend that Till found is basically due to satellites. And the increased scatter leads to a steeper stellar mass function. That's our prediction. And that's a range, you know, currently being probed by DES. They're looking for ultra faints in HSC, maglites, et cetera, a whole bunch of surveys. And LSHT should find a bunch of those also in the future. So thank you.
Okay, I'll start with Joel, and then Yao, and then Lisa.
So, Allison, as I've told you, I love your work,
Thank you.
But I want to pin you down on your very first slide. So you showed the Klippan-Karachensev slide, and that's combining the Papasterges alfalfa mm-hmm. data, the H1 data, which I think you've nicely explained how to interpret, along with the optical data, so-called nearby catalog that
that's
out
right.
to 11 megaparsecs.
The local volume catalog.
Local
yeah.
volume catalog.
Yeah.
And there they're trying to estimate basically what the velocities are, and they claim that there's this big discrepancy. Those are optical, not H1.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to say
I
about that?
I have included those in there. I skipped over that because most of the data is
That's
why
I wanted
H1.
To ask you.
Yeah.
One of the things that's always annoyed me about the data so far is they have not done a careful comparison. At least last time I asked Papasterges this, they still hadn't. Between the optical data and the H1 data to see.
Well, I thought Manolis had done it, actually.
Okay, maybe now he has.
Yeah,
okay.
That's possible.
Because that will help to resolve this.
Yeah, yeah. I think he did some careful work showing that those two results are consistent. But yeah, so I skipped over that. But to be as consistent with Klippan as possible, since I was comparing to Klippan, I included everything down. Klippan, in theory, has a. Is complete down to 10 to the 6 in stellar mass. So anything my simulations above 10 to the 6 in stellar mass, I included. And so many of those are dwarfs without gas, in which case you can either do what Klippan did, which is below some luminosity, all of those dwarf spherules have a velocity of 10 kilometers per second. So I could either adopt that or I could measure it directly from my simulations, and it turns out they're all about 10 kilometers per second anyway, so it didn't really matter how I did it.
Yarimau, Pittsburgh. So you showed the scatter at low mass n, it's about 0.9.
Mm-hmm.
If you now switch to this MP, does that reduce the scatter?
And if I switch, so if I'm looking at the scatter in,
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it does, right? So, yeah, why don't I just go back to that so you can.
So while you are switching, also related is that, do you treat subhalo and halo differently in your model that you predict the?
Yeah. So, yes, so you can see right here. So if I focus on the 10 to the 7 in halo mass, right? So this was 0.9. It now reduces down to something like 0.25. Right, so if you use the maximum halo mass instead. However, most of the people who are constructing these are not distinguishing between satellites and centrals, right? So it seems fair to leave at least at the low mass end. Certainly, in like the local volume, people are including satellites when they're determining the low mass stellar mass to halo mass relationship. So it seems fair to leave it in.
Okay, this is beautiful. It's great to see. But just on exactly that point, I mean. Certainly, many study or anything we've ever done in this range has done it based on the peak mass, and so it's actually encouraging that it's not dramatically higher when you do that. So I think it's just important to make that distinction because I agree with you that the literature is a little bit schizophrenic about it.
Right.
So some people are using the maximum, some people are using the current.
Right. I think it depends on the mass range that we're talking about. Yeah.
For the first part of the talk, I'm delighted to see you prove that W20 works a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I failed to mention too that the reason alfalfa doesn't use it is signal to noise. Right.
So I don't agree with that statement.
Oh, well, okay, the alfalfa people tell me.
If you had convinced them to switch to W20, but that's not my real question.
Yeah.
The real question is, have you looked at the shapes of the H1 profiles in your simulations and compared them to sort of the general trends that you see in the data?
I have not done anything more with them, but I think that would be, and especially after talking with Kareem yesterday, who it sounds like is doing that, it seems that would be a very interesting thing to do. Yeah. And no, I haven't convinced the alfalfa team to use W20. I mean, clearly I was working with Manolis on this, and this did not convince him. According to him, the signal to noise doesn't work.
Yeah, something kind of similar, whether or not you actually are producing H1 maps in your simulation that can then be.
We can. Yeah.
So and to compare, kind of similar to what Joel had said, to compare with the optical versus the H1,
mm-hmm.
because that's, I think, I also love your work. That's beautiful. But it'd be very interesting to go. Yeah, it's just fantastic. But it would just be interesting to dig deeper and see if, it relies on the fact that you are actually predicting. What you're saying is that width is what they're observing. For the same galaxies, and
yeah.
So to actually check that your H1 distribution, you've certainly now demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that this is plausible. But then, is it actually real?
Sure, fair enough. Okay.
regarding this plot, the scatter increases, but you're reaching limits where you have one or two star particles.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you try to make it correct, so first of all, when you quote 0.5 dex scatter. Is that in a log normal,
it's
or do you
normal
model
scatter.
It as a fraction of halos that have nothing plus a log normal?
We've done all of them. I've only shown the well-resolved results here. But yes, so the scatter is log normal scatter. We assume log normal scatter. In the paper, the scatter for the well-resolved halos, including all luminous halos and even including the dark halos, is included.
Okay. And have you tried to correct for Poisson noise in that scatter estimate?
No, we have not.
Is that good at some point? I think a smaller mass end could make up a significant component, I would guess.
Yes, fair point.
So this is a really important point, and I also, of course, love your work. I think I have the strongest evidence of that. However, I don't want people to go away thinking that if you use M-peak, then you get a really small scatter, because you haven't included photoionization squelching self-consistently, and others' work have shown that the photoionizing background will actually be dominated by nearby bright galaxies for these objects. So depending on the formation history of that nearby bright object, I think that you would get
you
much
get
larger
stochastic
scatter,
yeah.
Even in the M-peak relationship if you included that self-consistently. So it's not a criticism, but just a cautionary note.
Hi, Allison.
Hi.
I also love your work.
Make sure you don't give it to anybody who doesn't like my work, all right?
And for feedback, there's a special scale. It's the scale of the velocity dispersion of the halo is 10 millimeters a second. So that's the
mm-hmm.
velocity dispersion of photoionized gas. Where would that be on that diagram?
Here?
Yeah. Where would it be compared to the bend? Because that's another, if it occurs where the bend is, then that's an additional reason for expecting scatter.
What band, sorry?
The bend.
The bend.
I think there's a feature in that diagram. There's mm-hmm. a special scale that feedback knows about, and that's 10 kilometers a second. I just wonder where that is.
If somebody else can comment, but I would assume that it is pretty much near this, where the bend starts.
Okay, because that's another reason you would expect scatter at that scale.
Sure, that makes sense.
So the Loma Sand, you're basically relying on this effect of tidal mass loss, if I understood right.
That seems to be where the scatter is right. coming from, yeah.
So at 10 to the 7, for those that are satellites, I guess you probably have 10 to the 4 particles, or how many particles do you have?
Sure, they would have started off with, yeah. I mean, right. originally they had 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess my worry is, at that kind of resolution, numerical convergence of tidal mass loss is a bit tricky. I mean, I would not expect it to be really convergent.
Okay.
Because normally
I'd be interested in talking further about this then.
You know, like, there's a lot of work showing that million sort of number of particles, a million is about the threshold, even more, where you can start to really believe the tidal mass loss for these small objects. But I guess Frank maybe has a comment on this, because we were talking about that.
You are 100% correct.
Yeah, okay. All right, I'd like to follow up
so
with both of you.
So this is something we did long ago with Stelios, like 10 years ago, but
okay.
I think Frank has done more recent work on this
okay.
and showing similar things.
Okay.
Alison, here. Can you show the plot where you show correction, the correction reconciles the velocity?
In this one or in the H1 velocity?
H1 function? Velocity. Yeah. When I get the scale. So for this explanation to work, which I agree with, I thought that this will be how this will be resolved. But the corollary is that everything where you apply this correction, there's no significant fraction of stars that don't have a significant fraction of halos that don't have H1, right? Because the solid line.
Like I said, I did include spheroidal galaxies. So at the very in the very lowest mass bin, I do have spheroidals without H1 as well in order to compare to Clipin.
So how is it done? So how do you know which fraction of so you measure it from your simulation? So you apply a fraction of halos that don't have H1 and include it in the correction.
Yeah.
And
so
this
it's
is measured
actually,
from simulation. So how does
the mean? Correction is if you just like if you start with the theoretical Vmax function and then take what Munoz has done is taken this average trend essentially and populated a population of halos with it and asked what would be the observed velocity function that you would get.
Right, but there is also a fraction of halos that don't have H1, right? So the line, the solid line,
they're in here, right? So we didn't do anything with them. So I would down here there have to be. I've got.
How can you measure a W for something that doesn't
I don't. I take the velocity dispersion, which is also what Clipin did.
Might not have stars either. That's a very important point.
This is also, I mean, I can show you that. All right, so we did consider that, and I cut it out. So the other thing, like I said, is Clipin et al. Had a completeness above 10 to the 6 in stellar mass. So the other thing that we looked at is what fraction of my galaxies are actually luminous above 10 to the 6 in stellar mass. And you can see they're pretty sharp fall off, right? Somewhere around 30 kilometers per second. If you take that back to this theoretical line, this is the effect, right? So essentially above this abundance, you start to dramatically lose all your halos. So technically it's an abundance above where the data is. So I didn't bother including it in the talk, but yeah.
Can I make a point about it?
Yes, but we're just going to let him set up.
Okay.
Yes. So I think, Andre, you're absolutely right. So let's say Till Savala has a paper in 2013 where he went halfway towards explaining this just on the fact that it's like abundance matching fails because they're dark halos. So the same thing happens here. So I think the solution to the problem is partly the fact that you're in the regime where most of the halos are actually dark. And partly is the bias of W50 versus W20. So it's the two effects. And I think the crucial one actually is the first one, because Till found pretty much got very close to the observations just on the basis of the including the fraction that are dark.
Well, it's in there. I just skipped over it.
Okay, that was a great discussion. Let's thank Allison again.